Hey everybody, before we get to the latest episode of the podcast, we here at the Super Network would like to give a shout out and say thank you to Chazzy for being our latest subscriber on Patreon. Thank you so much, Chaz, for your support. We really and deeply appreciate it.
The following is a Super Network production with Super Marcy.
I hold back a lot. If I didn't, I would be my dark half.
The terrible Australian Bea Jermaine.
Probably the most iconic moment is the blood coming out of the elevator, definitely not in the book.
It contains coarse language.
What is going on? What?
Mature themes.
We all know that Stephen King writes bullies to the extreme.
Potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Please find us at supermarcy.com and subscribe to us via Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to The King Zone, the podcast where we go in depth and discuss the many different adaptations of Stephen King's work. I am your host, Super Marcy, from the Super Network and supermarcy.com. And this is our 15th episode of The King Zone, and we will be discussing the adaptations of Thinner, Trucks, and The Night Flyer. This episode, I am joined by my regular co-host and the other half of the Super Network team, the terrible Australian Bea Jermaine. Hello, Bea, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Marcy. How are you?
Doing all right. Had a crazy day so far, but I'm here. I made it.
Yeah, I'm a bit excited at the moment because at least at the time of this recording, it's just been announced that the website fthismovies.com has unleashed their calendar for June Sploitation. And for those out there who don't know what that is, it's just basically a month-long event where like each day you watch a movie from the calendar, but there's like a different like category for each day. Like one day could be like you got to watch a gangster film, or another day needs to be 80s horror, you know, like different days, like a different movie to watch each day based on the category. And I pretty much spent most of this morning before we were recorded just trying to come up which films I wanted to do for my viewing list next month. So I'm still working at it, but hopefully by the time this episode comes out, it should be all ready. I'll be all ready to go and prepared for June.
Yes. Well, at the recording of this podcast, I'm still debating whether or not I will do Junesploitation, so we'll see. It remains to be seen. But Bede, we are not alone for this episode of The King Zone. We are being joined by a returning guest and a favourite here at The King Zone. He is one third of the team at the Horror Returns podcast. Please welcome Lance.
Thanks, guys. Probably the only one on our team who's read every single Stephen King novel except the last two, I think.
That's a fair effort.
So if we do this, but when Marcy and I decided to do this podcast, you could have been our third co-host of this show.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the invite, guys. I'm a super big King fanatic, particularly with the books. Movies, not so much. They're hot or cold. So tonight should be fun because there's definitely some hot and some cold tonight. So let them rip.
Yeah, there is definitely a bit of hot and cold with what we'll be discussing. So let's get right into it and we'll discuss the first film on our agenda, 1996's Thinner.
Did you weigh yourself?
297.
Billy, you were 297 last week.
It takes some time for these diets to work.
For Billy Halleck, life is sweet. Bigger is better. And too much is never enough.
Winning!
Dear God, stop eating like that.
I can't help it, Heidi. All I think about is food.
But tonight, all of that will change.
You kill my daughter, and I curse her. Thinner.
From the best-selling novel by Stephen King comes the new shape of terror.
this diet you're on, what is it?
I don't think you'd like it, Henry.
I'm being erased.
Fear the power.
That old gypsy put a curse on me.
It's all your fault if you hadn't hit that old lady.
Beware the danger.
This is getting out of hand.
This has been out of hand, and I'm just the guy to put it back.
Believe the curse.
Please, take it off before this goes any further.
I never take it off.
Stephen King's Dinner. More terror. Less filling.
And the film, I'll read the synopsis off IMDb, and it's very lovely. An obese attorney is cursed by a gypsy to rapidly and uncontrollably lose weight. That's the gist of it, for reals. It was directed by Tom Holland, and not Spider-Man Tom Holland, the Tom Holland responsible for Fright Night and Child's Play. He also wrote the screenplay with Michael McDowell, and the film stars Robert John Burke, Lucinda Jenny, Bethany Joy Lenz, Joe Montana. I always get his name wrong. Joe Mantegna?
Yep, that's
sure.
It.
Sure. Sounds good.
And yeah, the cast list is acting up on my device. But I think, yeah, they're the main stars. And I think it's Kari Warraher.
Indeed.
I've said that wrong.
Sure. But,
I actually have.
Well done.
I think, seen her in a lot of stuff. She's also in this film. I apologize for that terrible introduction. let's get right into Thinner. For me, I haven't read the source material. But Lance, I'm sure you would have. So let us know, what do you think of, I guess, the book or the story?
Well, I remember I read the book when it first came out, and I've never gone. It's not one of those that I've liked so much that I've gone and revisited. It's kind of a thinner book as far as King goes, and that it's not like over 1,000 pages. More of a simple story, a quicker resolution. The strawberry rhubarb pie there at the end or whatever, you can't forget that, you know, that's kind of like the, I guess, the main point of the story, and yeah. that horrible decision that he has to make there at the end, and he's not a really nice guy. Mm-hmm. So the book I remember fairly enjoying as a, you know, kind of a quick read. But oh boy, what did Tom Holland do here? The best thing about this movie, okay, I will say this. Best thing about this movie is you get a pretty long, more than a cameo from Stephen King. Wouldn't you guys agree?
Yes.
Yes.
Other than that, oi.
Oi. Bede, what are your initial thoughts on the film? Because I don't believe you've read it.
No, I haven't, but I do know for a fact that this is the first adaptation of King's work, which is actually from when he was under the pseudonym of Richard Bachman. So this is the first Richard Bachman book we're covering for the show. But I guess for me, Finner, I remember watching this movie like as a teenager, especially when I started, you know, like getting into horror at that time. But even before that, I always remembered like seeing the video cover for this at the video shop.
Mm.
And I always kind of like
the gruesome one.
Yeah, exactly. Which is kind of the one that they use for all the movie posters and that. And that kind of image with, like, the skull.
Yeah.
And, like, over his face. It just, like, creeped me out as a kid. And then when I eventually watched it a few years later, I thought, you know, I thought it was okay. Nothing great. Nothing groundbreaking. But then having rewatched it again in prep for this episode, I have to say, I definitely enjoyed it a lot more. It's definitely one of the more simpler of King's stories, at least the ones that I've seen adapted into film, because the premise could easily have been, even though this was an actual full novel, I kind of get the impression like this story probably would have worked as well as a short story or a novella.
This could have easily have been done for something like with Masters of Horror, with sort of 50 to 60 minute format. I think you could have easily fit that in to that.
Oh yeah, definitely. But that being said, though, I still quite enjoyed it nonetheless. And I kind of found it as this kind of interesting kind of take on revenge and how far people will go to it. Because it's not only with Michael Constantine, who kind of curses our main character, Billy Halleck, played by Robert John Burke, to make him go thinner. But of course, you know, when as the progress of Billy's deterioration happens, even he goes on a revenge, and then it kind of just spirals out of control that way, where, you know, like this becomes far more violent and far more sort of tragic in the process, because more people kind of get caught up in this kind of revenge between the two of them. And I have to say, I found that quite engaging. And I think sort of compared to the last Tom Holland Stephen King adaptation we talked about on the show, which was The Langoliers, or as I like to call it, The Longoliers. I feel like this one has a bit more more atmosphere, a bit more of a visual style. And of course, it doesn't at 90 minutes, like, even though, like, it probably, like, you know, I agree, it could easily have been like, say, an episode of Masters of Horror. I do think, like, at 90 minutes was the perfect kind of length for this film, because it sort of touches on all the bases with the story and the characters. But that being said, though, it's not to say that it's entirely a great film. Like, there is a bit of cheesiness to the film as well.
Yep.
Okay. But that being and, you know, like,
there's another fanatic discussion tonight, aren't we?
definitely. But, like, that being said, though, like, and there are definitely some areas of the script I feel like the film could have easily explored a little bit more, particularly when it comes to the third act.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, like, Robert John Burke was really strong in the lead role as Billy. And even though, yeah, he's an unlikable asshole, you can't help but feel engaged by his character and also what happens to him throughout the film. And also quite the supporting, for most part, the supporting cast were pretty decent, particularly Joe Mantegna, who I felt was like the standout as like the sort of like mob character who helps Billy out. And also, I thought the makeup effects were really good, too, because, like, it's obvious, like, Robert John Burke is a very thin guy, so they had to basically put him in a fat suit. But the way how the
fat suit. Yeah, Weird Al Yankovic style.
Exactly. The thing is, though, what I liked about the makeup is how it sort of, like, shows how he slowly deteriorates and starts thinning out. And I thought the makeup did a really good job kind of showing that in a way that actually felt believable. And it was very subtle as well, because at times you couldn't even tell, like, oh yeah, he actually had lost a bit of weight, but then you realize, oh, he's actually lost way more than I thought. So but overall, I quite enjoyed this one. I mean, I went to put it up there as one of the better Stephen King film adaptations we've seen so far, but I quite enjoyed it for what it is.
Sounds like I need to do a rewatch.
Maybe you do. Look, as for me, I haven't read the book, so I have nothing to compare it to. It's just, you know, I judge it on its own merits. And yeah, I have, like you, Bede, I did have those memories of seeing that VHS cover, and it's ingrained in my memory because it was really freaky. And then when I eventually did watch the film, I think I might have watched it when I was profiling Tom Holland for my old column Dissecting the Director back in the day, and I actually really enjoyed it. Like, this is not, you know, the best film in the world. It is very, very silly. It is very cheesy. It's very quirky. There are some moments that there are a bit of pacing issues, but at the end of the day, for me, it's just more about that fun experience, that very over-the-top experience that I really enjoyed from this film. And I think that Robert John Burke is actually really, really good in this film. I really like what he brings to the table. He's a very versatile actor, and you would have seen him in, like, I think he was in RoboCop 3 as RoboCop.
Yeah, indeed.
Oh, and, wow. RoboCop himself, huh?
Yeah, he was a RoboCop. And he has been in, like, Law and Order. He was on Gossip Girl. So many other things, but they're the ones I always, you know, think of. And he's quite versatile, and I think he actually really does a good job of playing Billy in this film.
Mike Houston was here. Why did you leave the clinic?
Billy?
Billy, are you all right?
Fine.
We care about you, sweetheart. I care about you, Linda.
The doctors at the Glassman Clinic can't help me.
If they can't help you, who do you think can?
I went to see Duncan Hopley just before I came home. He offered to give me his gun. I didn't take it.
Oh, thank God.
I probably should have, though. I heard a gunshot after I left. I don't know, maybe old Dunk saw a rat in the corner and decided to do a little radical brain surgery on it, but I don't think so. Lemke cursed him, too. His face.
Please, please, please don't go through that curse thing again.
So what the hell else got to be hiding, huh? Huh? I'm not having diet. It's not anorexia. I don't have a taint worm. I've been eating like mad for over 6 weeks, 6, 10, 12,000 calories a day. At least, and I'm still losing weight. I'm being erased.
And I'm with you. I think the effects, for the most part, actually look quite good. It is very obvious in early on in the film that he is in the fat suit. And I think they did try their best, but it is just, you know, very obvious. But I think, you know, he lost a lot of weight for the role, I believe. He lost maybe 20 pounds or something. So I think for those scenes further in the film, it shows that gradual weight loss. And, I mean, the whole concept of getting a gypsy curse is very silly. And the fact that the curse kind of plays on your desires, but it has those really bad consequences. So for Billy, he eats a lot. He's very gluttonous and he really struggles to lose the weight. His wife is really trying to help and encourage him. Mm-hmm. And then once he's in this curse, he can just keep eating and eating and the weight just drops off. And at first it seems like, that's great, but this isn't going to stop till he's pretty much a skeleton. So it's not the best curse in the world. I mean, if I could eat all the food I wanted and then drop my weight to my ideal weight and just stay right there, that would be a great curse.
Problem is you can't turn it off.
Yeah, but unfortunately...
That's where you run into trouble.
Yeah, that's where we get the Stephen King aspect of it all. Obviously, I think Bede and myself had some more enjoyment than you, Lance, but you've told us about reading the book. What are your feelings of the film, and do you think you'll rewatch it with more of an open mind?
You know what? I might, but I will say this. I think the story is masterful because it is the irony, right? It's the monkey's paw. It's the, you know, careful what you wish for type thing. Although he never really verbalizes it. It's not like he goes to the gypsy to lose weight. You know what I mean? Mm. He ends up creating an offense, which gets him touched and it's downhill from there. But no, I like the irony because there are so many of us that struggle constantly with trying to keep our weight down and lose weight. And then, you know, of course, you can see, like, you bring out the gluttony part, Marcy. He was sneaking food there at the beginning, not being totally, he felt about being honest with his wife and his family, but just kind of like compulsive, right?
Yeah.
And he enjoyed the curse at first, right? He kind of had fun stuffing his face and trying all these different foods. And once he realized it was getting out of control, it was like the shit really hit the fan and he was ready to do anything, almost quite literally make a deal with the devil to get rid of this. So it's a great story. I love the way the story is fleshed out. I love the irony of it because it's what we all want, but it's turned up to 11, as they would say in Spinal Tap. the movie itself, I really did not enjoy the filming at all. Sorry, guys, but the fat suit took me out of it. I know that's horrible to say because it's a, you know, not a huge budget movie, I'm sure, and it's mid-90s, and they worked with what they would. You know, the actor did his part well, I think. I like some of the supporting cast, but I don't know. While I was watching this, I couldn't stop thinking the whole time that I was watching a parody of a Stephen King movie. It just felt like it was just too much like making fun of itself, not taking itself seriously. Obviously, I prefer the King stories that are, you know, more large in scale. I mean, Hell, The Stand is my favorite book he's ever written. And I was blown away by the new miniseries. So I love the big epic Stephen King stories. So sometimes it's hard for me to wrap my head around. Now, he did do one called Joyland several years ago, which he wrote under his, like, I guess, hard case books. Have you guys reviewed that one, Joyland?
No, because I don't think there's an adaptation of that one.
Ah, okay, you're right. But I'll bet there will be one, right?
You can there almost will be guarantee one. It.
Okay, yeah, it's a shorter one. It may only even be like 200, 250 pages, but yeah. That one I really enjoyed. I don't know. I couldn't stop thinking that I was watching a silly parody. Like I said, Weird Al Yankovic earlier, I literally felt like I was watching a Weird Al video. It was just mugging it up and hamming it up too much for me. You mentioned, Bede, that Joe Mantegna was the kind of the standout. You'll notice he's probably really the only one, I think, on this entire cast list that's really had a, you know, I would guess you would say star power type career.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think at this point when this film came out, he was probably the biggest name of the cast.
Oh, yeah, he definitely was.
Yeah,
he was
okay.
Doing a lot of very solid things in the 90s.
Yeah, and the old gypsy guy. God damn it. Who was that actor? I've seen that guy.
Michael Constantine. He was the dad in my Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Oh, my God. That's right. That's right. You know what? Wow. Okay. That now it's all coming together. I knew he looked incredibly familiar, although he was also under several pounds of makeup as well. But sorry, guys. Out of the three, this was my least favorite.
Wow. I think that's fair enough. And I definitely get where you're coming from, where it's like almost a self-parody, because it is quite silly and quirky, and it doesn't take itself all that seriously.
Yeah, that sums it up. I enjoy anything Stephen King writes. I'll read it. Even just finished reading Sleeping Beauties, which he wrote with, I guess, his other son, Owen. And it wasn't very good. You can tell the small parts that Stephen King went in and did the writing. But I don't know. Obviously my favorite author of all time. Not my favorite of his books, but I liked the book experience a lot more than I liked the film experience.
Mm. Well, I think that's fair enough. I definitely understand your point of view. And I could agree with several things. But I think for what didn't work for you was more enjoyable for me, and I think probably
that's awesome
for Bede. So it just goes to show we all have different tastes, different feelings, and we can all get along like awesome people that we are.
Absolutely.
No, I'm totally on the Fred Deger Lance after this podcast.
Oh no, don't do that, man.
I kid. I would never do that. But that being said, though, I gotta say, can we give a little? I mean, I don't know what it is, because wasn't it like when this movie came out, like Kerry Wara was like one of those actresses, like she was really gorgeous and she was just like popping up in everything.
Yes.
You could be right, because that name's super, super familiar.
Oh, she was in like Anaconda, Eight-Legged Freaks. She was in one of the Hellraiser sequels. She was in a whole bunch of stuff, but she was one of those actresses, like she just looked so, she was just absolutely gorgeous. And like, I think she probably would have had, and she definitely had the potential to have a bigger career, but I think she sort of kind of stumbled more in that sort of like, sort of B-grade movie kind of stuff and all that. But that being said, I thought she was quite good in this movie as well.
Yeah, fair. I have no problem with any of the acting. I couldn't get around the silly setup of the scenes and I couldn't get around the fat suit, goddammit. I fucking couldn't get around the fucking fat suit. I'm sorry. I kept visualizing Weird Al and eat it. I'm sorry.
Now that you've said that, I can't unthink it.
It's a personal thing. And 90s makeup, you know?
And it's funny, too, because this movie came out the same year as The Nutty Professor, which also had a lot of sort of...
Oh, God, did it ever.
Yeah, but that was, like, way better in that film than it was...
Well, I think they had more of a budget, man.
And also they had Rick Baker, too.
Well, sure, sure. Yeah. Big difference, right?
Yes.
Oh, I think so. So, as we normally do, we'll give the film a rating out of 5. Lance, what is your out of 5 rating for Thinner?
It's not horrible, but it's not great. So I'll give it a good 2 out of 5.
I was actually expecting a 2 out of 5 from you.
You got it. Yeah, you know how I think, Marcy.
Tapped in.
By the way, I appreciate that shout out to the QAnon shaman. You guys seen this poster for the Forever Purge, Beat? Have you seen it?
I have seen it, and then Marcy, I saw Marcy's retouching of it, having starring the QAnon shaman.
You know what? Who can miss that? Can you possibly miss that?
No. What? Like, I did not pay attention to that poster, but when I was listening to The Horror Returns, I think it was your... what was that other movie? Was it Vile and...
Oh, yeah, Spiral.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what we did last week. Yes.
So when you're talking about that and you say he looks like the QAnon shaman, I looked at that poster again and I'm just like, oh, my God. He's right. It does. Wow.
And I don't think any of our listeners will ever look at that poster the same way again now.
I hope not. I should hope not. We need to start a trend here.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you can't make fun of an attempt to overthrow the U.S. government, what can you make fun of?
Well, that's it, right? And to think that was like, what are we now? That was only 4 months ago. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, crazy.
It's weird. This year has gone so quick, but yet it feels like such a long time ago.
It's gone quickly. Maybe it's just because last year just felt like we were stuck in the muck. And then all of a sudden this year things are starting to open up again, at least here. I mean, do you guys have the cinemas open there yet?
Oh yeah, but we've had cinemas open since
Street.
Depending which area, but I think in Victoria they've been open since November, I think
it was November, December, and they only shut down when we had that very brief, like, 5-day lockdown.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Which feels like a lifetime ago now.
Yeah. Now, is that when the people were having sex in the hotel or something and spreading it that way? They were supposed to be
that was like the big lockdown when our city was locked down for like 3 months.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know what was going on there, but who knows? Aussies are weird. What can I say?
We're all weird, believe me. We've got our fair share of weirdness, as you can tell, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Exhibit A, QAnon Shaman.
There you go. You don't have to look much further than that, do you?
No. Bede, how many QAnon Shamans do you give Thinner out of 5?
I'm going to give a bit higher rating than Lance. So I'm going to give this one about 3.5 out of 5. I really enjoyed it. I think the first time I watched it, it was probably more of a 3, but I did enjoy it a lot more and appreciate it on a second viewing. So, and like I said, I would say it's one of the better Stephen King adaptations. It's definitely kind of middle tier, but it's still pretty enjoyable though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm on the same rating as you, Bede. I give it 3.5 out of 5. I just think I get so much enjoyment out of it that it gets that rating from me, even though, like, technically, yeah, it's not the best made film. For some of the reasons that it didn't work for Lance is part of my enjoyment from it. So, yeah. And that is our discussion on Thinner. Bede, I'm picking on you now.
No.
You want to give us a rundown of the next film we'll be talking about, which is, I believe it was 1997's Trucks.
From the short story by Stephen King, TriMark Pictures invites you to buckle up. You are now entering a town called Lunar.
Good morning.
First time in this part of the cosmos.
Looking for flying saucers?
Why would anyone want to live in a place like this?
Dad, it's too quiet here.
Where something strange is going on.
Electricity is out for most areas. It'll be at least 24 hours before we can get to you.
Can't get nothing on the CB.
Phones are out.
What's that?
Is there anyone driving?
Trucks don't drive by themselves. A mysterious force has taken hold.
These trucks appear to have an intelligence of talking to each other.
They're up to something.
And the traffic is way out of control.
Look out!
Thriller Without Breaks, starring Timothy Busfield.
Indeed. Of course, Trucks is based on the short story of the same name by Stephen King, and it was directed by Chris Thompson, and it was adapted by Brian Tegert, and it stars Timothy Busfield, Brenda Bake, I'm probably going to butcher the last thing. Brenda Bakey, I think.
Sure, sounds right.
Aidan Devine, Brendan Fletcher, and Amy Stewart, and many others. And the plot summary for this one, which, like Marcy, I'm also reading from IMDb, is aliens arrive, parking in a geostationary orbit over Nevada. Using powers unknown to us, they declare war and use unmanned trucks as weapons. I don't know who wrote that synopsis because it doesn't. It's so weirdly put together. Although, for our listeners out there who heard that synopsis and realized, why does that sound vaguely familiar? It's because the same story that this 1997 TV movie was based on was also the same one that Stephen King adapted into the film Maximum Overdrive, which he also directed. So. And if you want to hear our thoughts on that film, just go back to our previous episode of The King Zone, where we talked about that along with Sleepwalkers. Now, Lance, this was my first time watching Trucks. But I got to ask, what did you think of this 1997 TV movie? And have you read the short story it's based on? And also, how does it compare to Maximum Overdrive?
Okay, so it is a short story, and I read it in a compilation book, and it's been a very long time, so I don't remember a lot of the details. I did do a little bit of research when I was looking this movie up, and it does say it does point out a couple of scenes that are exactly the same from the book from the story itself that, you know, weren't in Maximum Overdrive, because that one just kind of went batshit crazy, which I enjoyed and appreciated. But I definitely would say that this was more serious, right? This was more, I don't want to say down to earth because it was still silly. but yeah, it was definitely trying to be a little darker, maybe a little grittier than Maximum Overdrive, which went a lot more for the laughs and the lines like, you sure make love like a hero. You know, who can forget that line? But yeah, oh, and of course, you know, the scrolling across the screen, talking about exactly how many days the asteroid had been going, had been there or whatever. Like, why the fuck do we really need to know this? But it was there. I enjoyed it. It was a fun watch. Like I said, I vaguely remember the story. I kind of, maybe it jogged my memory a little bit toward the end, a couple of the scenes that were quite different. Although they did keep the part in, I believe, right about the pumping, making them pump the gasoline and stuff like that. That was in both films, right?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah, it was okay. In both scenes where they basically, the trucks wanted me to refuel them.
Yeah, and this one did focus more right on vehicles, whereas Maximum Overdrive would have like a carving knife that got out of control and a fucking soda machine that hit a coach in the nuts with a full can of soda. Yes. And then, of course, who can forget the little kid that gets run over by the steamroller? Oh, you know what? Fuck trucks, guys. Let's talk about Maximum Overdrive. That's the really fun movie. This was passable. It was certainly passable. And so you said it was a made-for-TV film.
Yeah, it was. Made for TV and played in 1997.
Okay, so this is much, much higher on the scale than I would think any made-for-TV film from the 90s would be. Made-for-TV now, you know, of course, you got with all the streaming services and all the money going into that, you got a lot of great made-for-TV stuff. But back then, it was a dearth of quality films, to say the least. So I would say this one would probably stand out as one of the better made-for-TV. I just have to ask the question, why? I mean, why did they feel... I wish I'd researched that part of it. Hopefully one of you guys did. Why did they feel the need to the Brian Taggart or whoever wrote the script? Why? Why do you have to rewrite? Were they that pissed off about it? I mean, was Stephen King involved somehow? Was he so embarrassed because he's made it known that he was... you know, high on cocaine the whole time he did Maximum Overdrive, and maybe he's like trying to take it back or something somehow. That's the only question I've got is, was this really necessary? I mean, you already had a perfectly good film in Maximum Overdrive, in my opinion. Yeah. And this is just a short story. It's not even a novel.
Yeah, I guess, we got to remember at the time, this TV movie came out 11 years after Maximum Overdrive. Yeah. So I'm assuming that, because at the time when the film came out, it was trashed by critics, and of course Stephen King disowned it and everything. So I'm assuming like they thought, oh well, since the movie was quote unquote bad and didn't have, we're like, oh well, just do another version of it that will be quote unquote better than that version. But of course, as we've seen at the test of time, one of these two movies has been remembered a lot more, and the other one obviously has not. So,
yeah.
But Marcy, tell us your thoughts on Trucks.
Trucks needed a fuckload of cocaine.
Yes. There you go.
Look, I think... A truckload of cocaine. Yes. Well, look, I think Maximum Overdrive might not be the better made film, but I think it is the more enjoyable and more watchable film. I think there was definitely effort in Trucks to make it like a more grounded, serious, darker approach. And whether or not, you know, it could be that TV movie budget constraints or, you know, whatever they were trying to do, it just felt more, I think, bland than anything else. Like, I sat and watched it just fine. I just wasn't particularly overly engaged with it. I just wanted a bit more. Like, some of the scenes, like, as you mentioned earlier, like, they feel like they come out of nowhere with the tone of the film, and then it gets silly, but then it goes back to being serious. I think if it took more of a less serious approach, I think it would have been a better experience, at least for me personally. I do appreciate like what they were trying to do, but I don't think overall it quite worked for me. Bede, what about you?
This was my first time watching it. I do remember I do remember like Finna seeing the video cover for this down at the video shop. And for some reason I never rented it out, even though at that the time I was like getting into horror, so I'm surprised I didn't rent it out then. I think my 14, 15-year-old self might have enjoyed it, but I'm like you, this movie needed more drugs in its system.
Yep.
Because
or gasoline.
Exactly. And I like you guys, I was kind of curious to see like another version of this story just like played completely straight without the obvious influences of substances sprinkled throughout all of it. but the thing is though, watching it, I just felt bored by it. And and even though there are the occasional moment or two where it actually legit goes insane, and there's one scene in particular which I thought was so over the top and so out of tone with everything else in the movie because it's a scene that easily was more crazy than anything that happened in the film. And it's this scene where basically, like, I guess it was like these two kind of like these two guys were driving this truck, and I believe they were carrying toxic waste, I believe.
Oh, God, I'd forgotten all about those two jokers.
Yeah, and basically, and then they have, like, a hazmat suit in there, and it's attached to a tube, and then all of a sudden, the truck blows up the hazmat suit, with a lot of wind, and then somehow the hazmat suit comes alive, grabs an axe, and it kills the guys. I will give this TV movie credit. At least it tries to make sense, like, how, you know, these trucks come alive. Because it only focuses on the trucks, not other sort of machines.
Hazmat suits, too, right?
Yeah, because the hazmat suit is technically still connected to the truck, so it's a part of the truck. But that being said, I don't get how a hazmat suit, even if it is full of air, can grab an axe and kill someone. It's not attached to anything. It's not mechanical. It can't do that. So I don't get it.
Physics doesn't work that way, huh?
Exactly. And then, of course, we have another scene that could easily have been in the original film, which is a guy being attacked by a toy truck.
Yes.
And has his face smashed in over and over again. And when those scenes happen, I was like, oh, this is actually quite fun. But then when it kind of goes back to being serious, it just gets kind of boring, to be honest. And also the characters aren't all that interesting. They do lack kind of the charisma and the craziness and the cartoonish nature of a lot of the characters from the first movie. Even though there's, like, it's not to say that the acting was bad. Like, I think everyone does well with what they can. But there's nothing really sort of compelling about these characters. Although I got to say, though, watching this TV movie, I was just sitting there because I was, like, looking at the lead female character, Hope. And I'm just sitting there looking at her. I'm thinking, where have I seen her before? And then it clicked with me. I was like, oh, that's Brenda Bakey. She was like Topper's potential love interest in Hot Shots Part Deuce. So like the one with the mole and everything. Yeah. So that was like, oh, like I know where she's from now. And also Brendan Fletcher, who plays like the character of Ray's son. Like he's an actor who would go on to other things after this movie because he was like in Freddy vs. Jason, Tideland, and in a lot of Uwe Boll movies for some reason.
Oh, God. He should have stayed with trucks.
Exactly. Yeah. But, and, oh, he was in The Revenant as well.
Oh, wow. Talk about going from one extreme of filmmaking style to the other, huh?
He went from being in an Oscar-winning film like The Revenant and then doing an Uwe Boll movie the next.
Like one of the Blood Rain movies or something like that.
He was in both Blood Rain sequels.
And Blubberella? Did he show up in the one that was being
He was in Blubberella too. But he was like the lead in the Rampage films. So,
wow. Okay.
Like his career is fascinating to me.
He's out there working, right? You gotta respect that.
Exactly. Like he has to work, damn it. But I think overall, I mean, I didn't hate this TV movie, but it was just kind of bland and kind of forgettable, to be honest. And I hate comparing it back to Maximum Overdrive, but it's like apples and oranges between these two films. And like, granted, like Maximum Overdrive was definitely made under a lot of cocaine and other pills. but you know, there's something about that film that makes it quite memorable. And it's kind of interesting to me,
charming,
silly and over the top. And like, it's interesting kind of seeing these two together and sort of comparing to both approaches to the same source material, like one going a much more silly over the top vibe, like going for a much more silly over the top vibe, while this one's going for a much more serious approach. And I got to say, if I had to choose between the two, I'm going to go with the silly over the top vibe because it kind of suits the story a lot more than the serious approach does. Like it worked in something like Christine because that's, you know, due to the story, but yeah, I feel like if this film kind of went a bit more insane, like it does with that scene with the hazmat suit, I think it would have been a lot more fun.
Yeah, I think it needed more of that.
Right.
Mm. Yeah. Like, look, maybe an adaptation will happen of the story where it's like it mixes both the more serious elements with the funny elements and it'll actually work, but who knows?
Oh God, a third film based on trucks, really? Now that one would have to be pure parody, right? At this point.
At this point, you'd think so. So ratings out of 5. Lance, how many weird hazmat suits do you give?
Yeah, yes, 5. I love it. It's not terrible. I enjoyed watching it. I thought everybody did their part. Just not a lot of huge names in it. Now I understand why if it was made for TV movie in the 90s. But right down the middle, 2.5.
Fair. So for me, I'll just go to me. Whatever, Bede, you can wait.
how dare you?
Look, I'm probably going to give it 2.5 out of 5 as well. I think it's decent enough. It's watchable. It does suffer from taking itself way too seriously. It needed a bit more fun. And I think the pacing was a bit out of whack. And yeah, maybe it just needed a bit more oomph so it didn't feel like it was dragging in parts. And Beat, what about you? How many of those weird hazmat suits are you giving it out of 5?
I'm going to give it about a 2 out of 5. Like, I mean, I didn't hate watching it, but it was just kind of a dull experience, to be honest. It just needed to be a little... If it was a bit more crazier, I would have enjoyed it more. Not to say as crazy as Maximum Overdrive, but at least kind of have its own kind of over-the-top vibe that kind of suited the story. I feel like it probably worked a lot better, but yeah, I just found this completely just forgettable and kind of a bit boring, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that's all fair. And for our third film, for this podcast, we present to you The Night Flyer.
One, 01, Bravo, Lima. Come in, over. I can't have you sitting in the middle of my runway. Respond, over.
Also from 1997, the plot synopsis from IMDb. A reporter is on the trail of a vampiric murderer who travels by plane. This film stars Michael Ferrer. I probably said his name wrong.
Miguel Ferrer.
He passed Michael away Ferrer. Recently, right?
He did. I think it was like about a little while ago, actually, yeah.
I believe it was about 4 years ago.
And he was in the original Stand miniseries. I think he played Lloyd. He had a pretty standout role in that, and he was really good.
Yeah, I'll say it again. I don't know why I said the wrong name. Miguel Ferrer.
Perfect.
Jesus, Marcy, what's wrong with you? That's actually all you need to know. He is the star of this film.
Yeah, I got it.
It also stars Julie and Russell, Dan Monahan, Michael H. Moss, and John Beans. Directed by Mark Pavia. Not sure what else he's actually had done.
He's only directed one other movie since this one, and it only like came out, I think, 4 years ago, called Fender Bender.
Because he's mostly written screenplays, which he also wrote this, and the other screenplay credit is to Jack O'Donnell. And The Night Flyer was, much like Thinner, a theatrical film, not a TV movie. So, I've been picking on Lance to go first each and every time, so I'm going to pick on Bede this time.
Indeed. But before I get into my thoughts on The Night Flyer, I forgot to mention this during Trucks.
Oh.
You know, the director of that movie, Marcy, Chris Thompson, you know he's an Australian, and you know what episodes of a TV show he directed way before making that movie?
What?
A Country Practice.
Wow.
And he also directed The Delinquent starring Kylie Minogue.
Oh, okay. I know who that is. I had no idea that was the same person. Okay.
Yeah, when I was like doing research, like after watching the movie, it's like, whoa. So he's basically the second Australian who has done a Stephen King film that we've covered on this podcast. And the first being on the Tommyknockers.
Oh, Tommyknockers knocking at your door.
Yes.
I've tried to erase that from my memory.
I'm sorry,
laser lipstick.
but my thoughts on The Night Flyer. The Night Flyer is actually an interesting one for a lot of reasons. I think what's interesting about this, even though this was a theatrical release film, it actually did play on HBO first before going theatrical. So,
really?
Like, yeah, so it kind of did like a... Side. Yeah, I think they were sort of like put it out on HBO just for a little bit so it can play. And then they released it theatrically, like I think a few months later. At least this is what I'm reading up right now. But
that's interesting. The late 90s, they didn't do a whole lot of that. It was pretty much straight theater only for at least six months.
Yeah, so they're basically, HBO was kind of doing all this type of thing before doing it with HBO Max that they're kind of doing at the moment. But that being said, though, in terms of The Night Flyer, I did see this movie when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And like, I just sort of, I remembered liking it at the time, but it was interesting. And this was out of the three films we were going to be discussing for this episode. This is the one I was most looking forward to because until recently, I had not seen it in like maybe 23 years.
Wow.
So but that's the thing though, because this movie's not as readily available as, you know, as other Stephen King adaptations are at the moment. So, you know, you kind of, it's out there on DVD and stuff like that, but it hasn't been released on Blu-ray. It's hard to find on streaming and stuff. So, you know, you have to look around to find it. But that being said, though, I was kind of curious to see how I would feel about this film on a rewatch. Like, would I like it more? Would I dislike it? And I got to say, I think this is without a doubt one of the most underrated Stephen King film adaptations. Because what I think is really good about this film is it has a really interesting and unique concept for a vampire film. Although it's one that, if you honestly think about it, probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but the movie still does a good job with it making it creepy and compelling that it's not too much of a bother. And also, like, Miguel Ferrer, and this is like a rare lead role for him, and I thought he was terrific in the role as Richard Dees. And he's, again, like Robert John Burke in Finner, like, he's a character who's a complete scumbag, but you can't help but kind of feel engaged by him because he's such an interesting character, and he brings a lot of layers to that role that sort of make him both interesting and compelling. And I also like the mystery of it about this, him going, try as a sort of a tabloid reporter, trying to track down this mysterious vampire that sort of flies from, you know, like airport to airport and kills people. And like that itself was really interesting and compelling. And also, like, the film is also can be legit creepy at times too, particularly in the third act, which we'll definitely need to talk about. But I think what's interesting though is, I think this film has a really interesting sort of subtext about how tabloid journalism and vampirism are kind of the same thing. And I think the film, Mark Parvioni's co-writer, Jack O'Donnell, I think they do a really great job at sort of like showing how, in a way, like these two separate things have a lot more in common with each other than you had initially thought. Because, of course, you know, you're a vampire, goes around, like, kills people and sucks their blood. But tabloid journalism is basically these people who have no morals whatsoever and basically will go from crime scene to crime scene, take photos and try to look for the goriest stuff so they can sell papers. And, like, there's a lot of interesting sort of subtext to this film that really makes it quite interesting. And for me, it just made the film even better as a whole. And also, like, the vampire itself, whose name, I'm trying to remember what the vampire's name was. Dwight Renfield. That's
yeah, sure. I knew it was a take on.
That's right. Dracula. That's right. They tied the name to the character.
Which, because this is a movie that really does, has a lot of references to a lot of vampire works. But I think the design of the vampire itself is so unique and creepy, and they do a really spectacular job with the design of that of Renfield in this film, and it's a very memorable one. You don't see him much, but when you actually do see what he looks like in the last half, you just don't forget it. And that's one of the things I think watching this film again, I always remembered that design of the vampire, and it just stuck with me the first time I watched it, and I still think it really works even more so now. So, I think this is a really strong... I mean, I haven't read the original source material, so I can't compare, but I think as a film on its own, it's definitely one of the more underrated Stephen King adaptations we've covered so far for the show.
Definitely. Lance, what are your thoughts on Night Flyer? And I'm pretty sure you would have read the source material. If so, tell us about that.
Yeah, I read it in, I think it was the Nightmares and Dreamscapes, which was a story anthology that came out just a couple of years before this, I think, or pretty close to the same time. I think a lot of the short stories that he puts in those compilations, though, were maybe like in, shall we say, gentlemen's magazines and things like that. He did a lot of that kind of stuff. I guess it was easy money, but yeah. I was dreading watching this movie, guys. I really was. This is one of those Stephen King stories that when I was reading it, of course, you know, I was flipping through the book with all the other stories in it. But I remember this one being one of my least favorites, probably one of my least favorites of anything he's written. I just found the story, I don't know, I just couldn't get into it for some reason. I don't know if I would say it was bland, or I just couldn't relate to any of the characters in the book, but man, I'm glad I watched this. I think it is about 99% Miguel Ferrer in his performance that he puts in. Bede, you blew my mind when you were talking about the vampirism of the reporters, or as they call them. Well, I guess they call lawyers ambulance chasers. What do they call paparazzi is one term, but there's other. I guess that's more of a highbrow type, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what the. I know they were called something in the film, but I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, struggling to remember, but the actual like metaphorical way that they compare like what these reporters are doing to like the blood sucking vampire, I think was so well done and so well captured in this film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, agreed. And I think this is some of the best vampire makeup I've ever seen in my life. I mean, Fright Night was awesome, right? Especially the scene toward the end where he really became his true self. That was terrifying. This might be a step up. This is some of the better vampire makeups and, you know, more frightening vampire makeup that I've seen in any films that I can remember watching. This is not your you know, sexual Lestat or your sparkly Edward or anything like that, right? This is this, we know where this dude's we know what he's after, and he's gonna get it no matter what. And I guess it is on retrospect kind of a clever idea to have him go from airport to airport. And I thought maybe when I read the book that struck me as a little bit corny, you know, kind of a silly idea, but I don't know. Maybe it's just Mark Pavia's filmmaking style or whatever, but I don't know. I think they really pulled it off here. It was good acting. It kept me compelled the whole time. I watched it on my lunch break at work, and normally when I do that with a film, I'm not giving it all my attention because inevitably I'll have, you know, a phone call or two come in during my lunchtime that I have to, you know, stop and take. Which is why I don't feel guilty taking an hour and a half instead of an hour. but yeah, that was a nice, concise film. Speaking of an hour and a half, perfect runtime. You got the story in. You had a great build up to the third act of the crescendo. You had a great reveal, and then you had some darkness there at the end that I wasn't necessarily expecting. So yeah, hats off. Cheers, guys. Thanks for having me watch this, because I really avoided the film. I really did. I thought, you know what, I'll get to it eventually. I'll never see every Stephen King film. I've definitely read everything, or will read the last few I have to read. And then hopefully he'll continue for many decades to come, of course, because he is immortal. And he could certainly teach our friend George R.R. Martin a lesson or two. as could Taylor Sheridan. The filmmaker, or the primarily writer, but also filmmaker. This guy has directed three major films, or written or directed three major films this last year, and he writes literally every single episode of the TV series Yellowstone. Who does that?
A crazy person.
I mean, good God. I mean, if you heard our shaman talk, you heard our talk about him, but... yeah, no, very prolific writer. You're going to have a few stories that are duds to a certain reader, and this was one for me, but the film was just great fun.
Yeah.
And what about you, Marcy?
Yeah, look, there's not a whole lot I can add to what you've both said. Like yourselves, I actually really, really liked my most recent viewing of this. I did see it several years ago, and I didn't remember too much about it. So I was quite looking forward to revisiting it. And I've always been a fan of, and I'll get his name right this time, Miguel Ferrer. I don't know where I got Michael from before. What was wrong with me? I've always been a fan. I think he's great. And he has been, as we mentioned, he has been in other Stephen King adaptations. Like he was in the original The Stand, and he was also in the miniseries of The Shining. And I think, like, yeah, you don't see him as much as that leading role, but he really carries this film. And him being very integral to the film, I think makes it such a compelling watch. And the character of Richard Dees is not the most likable character, kind of when we talk about Thinner with the main character there, Billy, not really being that likable. I don't think Dees is all that likable, but he's very interesting to be around. And as we talked about, the metaphor with the kind of reporting, that kind of tabloid, very exploitative type of reporting, and in, you know, whatever you want to call it, investigative journalism, the comparison to the blood-sucking vampire, like, it is subtle in this film, but it really packs a punch with it, and it does make you realize excuse me, just how exploitative a lot of the things that, you know, those rag magazines or papers do. And I really think that, you know, getting into that and having those themes and messages really elevates it quite a lot. It's not just a vampire film. It definitely has a lot more to it. And it is quite a different vampire film, where this is, you know, a monster who does travel. He has his, you know, the Night Flyer plane. He goes to different places and kills people. And he looks like that monster design, that vampire design is incredible. It's so different to a lot of things that we've seen before, and you have to give credit for the creation of that. And for me, it kind of goes hand in hand a little bit with, like, Salem's Lot, because those vampires were, you know, almost scary and really good effects for that, at least in the original Salem's Lot. And there is, for me, I think Stephen King really understands how to do a vampire story and how to make it very different to what we've seen before, but he also adds in those interesting subtexts and metaphors. And for me, this film at least really captures all of that, and it is quite a great, you know, little package all bundled together. So for me, yeah, like you said, Bede, I think The Night Flyer is definitely one of the more underrated Stephen King adaptations we've done for the show, and I definitely highly recommend people check this out. And when I watched this again several weeks ago in prep for this podcast, I did make a tweet that one of my ideal double features, and one that I definitely want to do now, would be to watch this, The Night Flyer, along with Nightcrawler, which does go over similar themes about the, I guess, exploitation and you know, that underbelly, that seedy underbelly of the, you know, reporters, and I can't think of the right name I want to use, but you know what I mean.
Sensationalist, maybe?
Or, yeah.
There's no, yeah. That's not the word. It's, God, we'll think of it. We're going to think of it.
Yeah.
Or but maybe it is, somebody will write in or post something in the group, right?
But they do sort of, you know, over-sensationalize things and capture things, or, you know, even manipulate things for that story. So I think those two films would make a really good double feature that will probably leave, you know, once you finish watching, you'll probably just want to cry, honestly.
Can we talk about, like, I really want to dive into this scene in particular. Can we talk about the ending of this film where Richard Dees finally tracks down Dwight Renfield at this much more larger airport? Like, at the point of this film, like, Renfield only sort of targeted smaller airports, you know, like little ones, like in back roads of countries. But then, as he's tracking, at first Deez is like, oh, he wouldn't go to a big airport because, you know, he'd be more noticeable. But then, of course, he finally tracks him. Mm. And throughout this whole film, you can obviously tell Renfield keeps leaving messages for Deez, like, stop what you're doing and stuff like that. Don't follow me. And then once you get to the airport, and then once Deez goes inside, it's like a complete, utter massacre where bodies and blood everywhere.
Oh, yeah. And then, he fucked him over good, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. And also, basically, and from there, it is this basic Renfield kind of shows him like the ghost of Dee's past coming back to haunt him in this really chilling scene that is shot entirely in black and white. And of course, like all the people in the airport sort of rise up in sort of this vampiric state. But it's obvious that it's not just the people, it's also, I mean, the people at the airport who have just been killed, but also people who, Deez has done stories on in the past, including the woman, like one of his co-workers who was killed herself in the bathtub. And instead of letting any, because early in the film there's a flashback where he got there before the police, and instead of like ringing for help and stuff, he just took photos of her.
Oh my God.
Of her body.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's just basically like that sort of all those horrible things have now come back to literally claim him. And of course, it sort of ends with basically Renfield framing him, and I think that the whole section of the film is just really well done, and it's just so genuinely creepy, especially the scene in the bathroom where you see where Renfield and Deez are having a conversation. Of course, we can see like Renfield behind Deez in certain shots, but you don't see him in the mirror.
Yeah.
But you see, like, things getting broken and cracked and everything like that. It's so well done.
And when you don't see the reflection, you actually do see Dwight Renfield there. And I think that whole scene in the bathroom, like, it's so well done. I don't know, like, how they quite pulled it off. It was probably something very simple.
An empty wall or something.
Yeah, but it looks and feels like it's such a great section. Like, it is definitely a terrifying scene. But how do you guys, I guess, interpret the ending? Do you feel like the character of Deez is destined to, you know, he can see himself in the Dwight Renfield, the vampire? Do you think that it kind of like all this stuff claimed him, and that the female reporter is, you know, destined to become like the new Deez? Like, how do you interpret it?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, like she kind of takes over at that point. I can see that. It tricked me a little bit. I really thought there for a minute that Deez was going to become the next vampire or a protege or something like that. But he kind of just basically, he got him to take all the blame. And then, as you said, the other reporter was more than happy to just kind of sensationalize that and sort of suck the blood out of Deez. Poor
it's
bastard,
like,
man.
It's like it's going full circle in a way.
You know what? I suppose it is. I just think Stephen King has a lot of stories that have dark endings, and you know, of course, we all saw The Mist, where the ending of the book was upbeat, but the ending of the film was super dark. So I was a little bit surprised it went as full batshit crazy as it did with putting Richard Deez in that situation. I'll tell you what, it was a rough ending for poor Deez, sure.
It really was.
And I liked Julie Entwistle, who played
Catherine.
What's interesting, because when I was doing my research on the film, her character wasn't in the original short story. So she was created just for the film.
Okay.
And I do like the sort of the contrast between her and Deez, because she's like this new person who's just been hired. She's definitely much more idealistic and wants to be a serious reporter. And of course, you know, you see her kind of not sure she wants to be part of the tabloid journalism, especially how it's sort of done. And then, of course, like, she decides, you know what, I might as well embrace this. And then as the film progresses, like, she's a pretty smart character, because she sort of, like, figures out all the sort of the details on Renfield. But it's really Deez who kind of steals all her ideas and tries to claim him as his own. And he's the one who wants to kind of take all the credit. And of course, like, there's a great scene where she and Deez have a conversation in a bar, which is actually a really great Pete scene because Miguel Ferrer just acts the hell out of that scene.
Yeah.
Boy, what an exciting first day this turned out to be. I already got my first assignment, a piece about a psycho pilot who thinks he's a vampire.
Yeah, I know. I already pissed on him. I passed on it. Why are you here, Jimmy? I doubt that you followed me all this way just to shoot the shit.
I didn't follow you. I was just...
It doesn't matter. You're here now. What do you want?
Well, okay. I guess I was hoping that you could give me the inside view of Inside View. Who better to learn from than the paper's star reporter? Maybe you could share your philosophy with me.
My philosophy?
Your secret for staying on top for so long. I'd love to hear it. That is, if you have one.
Okay. Here it is. You better take notes. Never believe what you publish. And never publish what you believe. Doesn't matter, I talk too fast.
Well, I guess I was just expecting something more. From someone who thinks of himself as...
As a what?
Well, a real reporter.
Huh. Huh. Let me ask you a question. What the fuck do you think you know about being a real reporter, huh? God damn it!
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend you. Why don't we start over?
Why? I gotta know your story, honey. I heard it a million times. You come from Lockport or Rockport or Bridgeport or Eugene, Oregon or some goddamn place. You tried to get into Columbia or Yale. Ended up at Illinois State, didn't you? And you interned for Examiner, the Patriot. What? Help me here, please.
The Herald?
Herald, exactly. That's right. You covered everything from cake sales to dog shows to class reunions, but they got a little mundane for you, didn't it? She came to us for just a little more spice.
And I just like it because one of the things like Deez keeps telling her, told her in that scene and as well as others, is like, never believe what you publish, never publish what you believe. And I think it's sort of like at the end, it's sort of that whole sort of line comes full circle in the end, whether like, should she publish the truth about what happened and Deez is innocent, or kind of just let Deez take all the blame and so that the Nightfly can continue what he's doing but not come after her in some way. So I think the film does a really good job with tackling that in the film. And I've got to say, watching this film, like the boss character, played by Dan Monahan, I kept watching this film and I kept looking at him again like Brenda Bakey in the Trucks. I'm like, where have I seen him before? Like, I kept thinking,
right?
I kept thinking who he was, and now just looking up who he is, I've just realized, and to my shock, he played Pee-wee in the Porky's films.
Oh God, Porky's! What a blast from the past that was.
So it's kind of interesting seeing him in this film, but yeah, I mean, I guess if any criticisms I have with the film is like even though this was made for cinemas, it does feel, I mean, visually it does feel a bit TV movie-ish at times, just in certain areas, but other times it does actually have a really good atmosphere and cinematic style to it. But outside of that, though, I think it's a surprisingly great film.
Yeah, I agree. It definitely is a really great film, and as we've said already, one of the underrated little gems that you find with the Stephen King adaptations. And I think it goes to show that Miguel Ferrer really could like lead a film. He was very capable of being a leading man, not just like a supporting cast or I think he ended up becoming like, oh, it's that guy kind of actors. Mm-hmm. And you know, it is a shame that he didn't get to do more leading roles, because I think he was such a great and strong actor, and he always had such an incredible screen presence
and a great voice too. And I gotta say, I just now realize Miguel Ferrer was also in Hot Shots Part Deuce as well.
Oh wow, well there you go, full circle.
But I gotta, before we sort of wrap up the talk, there's one section of what I love about this film, and there's a scene where I believe it's both Dee's and Catherine as well. They like go onto this wall and has like all these like all the covers of previous issues of the magazine like up on the wall. And I sort of looked at them and I had to pause the movie just to have a good look at some of these. And I realized all the covers are actually of stories that are taken from other Stephen King stories. And there's a list of them here on IMDb. So I'll read a few of them. Like one of them is Springheel Jack Strikes Again, which is from is a reference to the short story Strawberry Spring. Headless LeMay's leads to successful birth, which is from The Breathing Method. Okay. Kitty cultists in Kansas worship creepy voodoo god, which of course is a reference to Children of the Corn. Satanic shopkeeper sells gory goodies, which of course is references Needful Things.
Yep.
And the next two, which are from movies we've also covered as well, are Naked Demon Leveled My Lawn, which of course is referencing the original short story The Lawnmower Man. And the tie back to Finna, The Ultimate Killer Diet, Gypsy Curse Flays Fat Lawyer's Flesh.
Oh, wow. Those are spot on.
So it was kind of interesting seeing those, because those are ones you kind of have to pause the movie to see because they kind of blink or you miss them. But it was really fun to see and read all these covers and see like, oh, they actually put effort into kind of referencing all these other events that also these, you know, referencing other these Stephen King stories, but saying like, oh, these things also happen in the universe of this film as well.
Wow, that they were doing an Easter egg before Easter eggs were even around.
Exactly.
So let's do our ratings. Bede, how many Dwight Renfields out of 5 do you give The Night Flyer?
I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5, Marcy. I really enjoyed this one, and this was a great rewatch. Like I said, I was kind of curious to see how it would hold up, especially after not seeing it for so long. But I got to say, this is definitely a great movie, and without a doubt, one of the most underrated Stephen King films we've discussed so far for this show. And I think it's one that everyone should definitely check out, for sure.
Lance, how many Dwight Renfields out of 5 do you give The Night Flyer?
Okay, same score. Same exact score. 4 out of 5. Easily my favorite of the three. This one was a real treat. Not what I was expecting from the story. And if you're saying that the second reporter is new to this, that makes sense because she did add a lot of depth. There was a lot of cat and mouse with those two and a lot of one-upsmanship. And it always kept you on the edge of your seat. And then at times it was almost like the vampire story was the backstory and it was about these two. So well done. Well done film.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I think the addition of the character added so much more to the story, which definitely worked in its favor. And for my rating out of 5, I'm giving it 4 Dwight Renfields out of 5 as well. We are all the same score. Might be a first, I don't know. But I think we could safely say we all really enjoyed the shit out of this film. And if you haven't seen it, please, people, track it down, watch it. It is well worth your time.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's out there. I'm trying to figure out where it's streaming in the States here, because I did watch it streaming. I might have found it on YouTube, guys.
Yeah, I know it's on YouTube, but
okay. I think that's where I must have seen it then.
Yeah, because outside of YouTube, I don't know where else it's streaming. But I hope someday this movie gets a proper release, so it'd be really cool if it does.
Yeah, someone really needs to do, like, you know, a really cool, like, 4K restoration or something.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That'd be very epic. And I think that wraps up this installment of the King Zone podcast. Thank you all very much for joining me. Well, I guess you have to, but
yeah. I tried to get out of this podcast, but you know, you kept convincing me to be on it, so
it was a lot of fun. It was very insightful. I had some really good discussions about these films. So where people can find us on the internet or wherever, we'll run you through that. So you can find us at supermarcy.com, We are the Super Network. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesupernetwork. You can join our fun and crazy Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/thesupernetwork. Group. And you can, of course, vote in our monthly polls for fan-voted commentaries for the Super Podcast, our other show. You can follow me, if you so desire, on Twitter at twitter.com/supermarcy. You can also follow the Super Network on Twitter at twitter.com/sm_thesupernetwork. You can join us on Instagram at Instagram with our username, the.super.network, and you can find us on TikTok at the Super Network.
And oh, God, you crazy kids and your TikTok, I swear.
Yes, we are. And, of course, we are also on the YouTubes, which you can find us by searching for the Super Network, or you can, you know, look up one of the names of our podcasts, and we are streaming. The King Zone is available either under the King Zone podcast or under the Super Net, under the Super Podcast banner at all good podcast streaming services such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Deezer, iHeartRadio, all of them. Beat, where can people check you out if they so desire?
Well, if people want to check out any of my stuff, they can follow me at my Twitter at twitter.com/bjamine, or they can read up all my work over at my personal writers page on Facebook at facebook.com/terribleaussie. But of course, you can always find all my writings, both reviews and columns and whatnot, over at supermarcy.com. So I got a lot of cool stuff in the pipeline at the moment, so keep a lookout for it over there.
Very exciting. And Mr. Lance, where can people check out your stuff?
Oh, just Google us. I mean, here's the deal. We actually do, I do have an announcement. Actually, this is the first time I've announced this. So you're hearing it here before our home podcast. But we do actually, we have rented, of course, you never own a domain name, but we have actually rented the horror, www.thehorrorreturns.com. Woo-hoo! So we'll slowly be moving everything over to that. So we'll have a centralized location. But in the meantime, yeah, we're at thehorrorreturns.podbean.com on iTunes and all that. We are doing contests all the time. We're giving, I think Brian has about 4 different Steelbox Blu-rays to give away for Apple Podcast reviews. So please leave those. Facebook discussion group. Beautiful artwork by Marcy, enhanced artwork with the name of the true star of the Forever Purge.
Yes.
Right there, of course.
Forever Purge.
But we do have, I will tell you this, we've got several sideshows. We have Stream Fiends where we do something streaming. We have the Action Returns now. We have the Wrestling Returns now by popular demand. As far as our regular show, we were just talking about doing Spiral for the Book of Saw. But I have been meticulously re-uploading, in case you haven't noticed, if you follow our link, every single fucking episode from number one. Why am I doing this, you may ask? Well, apparently some sort of bot found that we were using some music that was copyrighted.
Uh-oh.
And even though we're a completely not-for-profit, I'm not sure if it's the fact that we have a Patreon set up to help defray some expenses or whatever, but for whatever reason, you know what? I figure if you can't beat them, join them. Took everything down. We're putting it back up one by one just without the music. So
yeah,
there you go. We're up to number 16. I've got a long way to go.
Yep, I have noticed this with, because, we, you know, we've had the YouTube channel for quite some time, and we do post up the podcast previews, and I have to be very meticulous not to have any outside audio when I do those previews, so it just has to be us. And if we have a guest for that episode, for that small snippet on YouTube, it's crazy. But it's great that you guys are going to have your own domain and a centralized location. So everyone, please look up the Horror Returns podcast. And I'm still waiting for my invitation for the wrestling returns, just saying.
Ah, I'm sure Brian's listening, so it'll be going out soon.
I can assure you. Nudge, Brian.
and we're like a lot of the horror podcasts. We're always desperate for female guest stars, so you're welcome anytime, Marcy. You know that.
Yes, absolutely. I am the shining female voice of the podcast world.
Exactly.
We like to get different perspectives, you know. We don't want to keep everything just did you see that hot chick, you know? Because unfortunately we do devolve into a lot of that type of crap. So
it's always a sausage fest.
Exactly. We need to be tempered, Marcy.
Yes, you do. But thank you so much, Lance. We look forward to podcasting with you in the near future, and I'm sure you will be back for more King Zone at some point, because I feel like this is the podcast that will never end, because there are like 10 or 15 something Stephen King adaptations in the works. And the one you mentioned earlier, that book, Joy something.
Oh, Joyland. Yeah,
yes,
Joyland.
That is apparently in development.
There you go. So it shall be covered soon. Yeah, I'd like to talk about that one. That one really hit me emotionally. There is a lot. That book's going to stay with me. Like I said, not an epic, and I normally like his epics, but that was such a tender story and just a beautiful, beautifully written story. So yeah, I would love to be on that show if and when that film ever comes out.
Yeah, nice. Well, as of now, at least it shows up as being, I guess, coming soon in development, to be determined. I can just read this list. It's from Wikipedia of the upcoming adaptations. There's The Boogeyman, The Breathing Method, another Dark Half, Elevation, another Firestarter.
That's
from a Buick 8, The Girl Who Loved Gordon, The Little Green God of Agony, The Long Walk, Mile 81, Mr. Harrington's Phone, Rest Stop, The Running Man Again, Revival, Salem's Lot, Throttle, and The Tommyknockers.
You're gotta be fucking kidding me. The Tommyknockers? Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, maybe they'll get it right this time. They'll have... Instead of laser lipstick, they'll have exploding eyeliner.
And that's just like what will be, I guess, theatrical for TV. We've got Lycie's Story, The Institute, Chapel Waits, The Jaunt, Joyland, Revelation, Sleeping Beauties, The Talisman, and The 10 O'Clock People.
Okay.
So
Joyland is going to be a series.
Well, it'll either be a mini series or a TV movie or something, but yeah, it's under the TV section. So
interesting.
There you go. Like I said, we'll be doing this podcast till we're in the old folks' home.
Oh, well, we have like at least another, I think 16, 17 set episodes. So basically, once we go through those episodes, like basically after when that's done, the King Zone probably won't be as frequent, but we'll do an episode when an actual Stephen King adaptation comes out and we do an episode on it. So
at this rate, because we're doing it once a month, so we still have at least a year and a half left, I think we're still going to be progressively doing it once a month for 2 years. I feel like that's going to happen.
Definitely.
And with that, again, thank you to everyone for listening and checking us out. We really, really appreciate it. Please, if you would like to, if you're on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating and review. That would be super duper amazing. And I guess until next time, I've been super. Bede's been terrible. Lance is a little bit obsessed with Q Sharman being in a Purge movie. And we're going to attempt to, you know, if we ever get back to airports properly, we're going to avoid running into Dwight Renfield.
Wise.
So thank you, everyone, and good luck and good night.
See you, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye.
constant pout. You sleep all day and all night you're out. You didn't observe no warning sign. No, no. You cross the line. While you were sleeping late last night, you thought your dreams were locked up tight. His name slipped out in a lonely side. Yeah. You cross the line.
I've been watching you, D's. I've been watching you very closely. Yes, I know you, you see. I know all about you. I trust you now understand that you can never write of what you know, can never reveal what you have seen. Open your camera now! So are you. For now at least. This is your last chance, my would-be biographer. Open your camera or I'll do it! Your appetite for blood intrigues me. We have a lot in common, you and I.